Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
I'd like to welcome everybody to the Doctors Roundtable radio show today, and I so appreciate you listening. I promise you this will be a very interesting show today, and we're glad you all tuned in. With me in the studio, I have a reproductive endocrinology and urologist with me today. We're going to talk about male infertility, and I have Dr. Michael Witt with me. So welcome, Dr. Witt.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We actually had one of his partners, Dr. Dorothy Mitchell-Leaf, on about 3 or 4 months ago, and in her passing, she said, Tanya, you need to have the guys come back and talk about that part of the equation. So hence, you're here today to kind of fill in the gaps for us, and we appreciate that.
That's great. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah. Let me tell you all a little bit about Dr. Witt. He obtained his medical degree from Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, and then went on to do a residency in urology, which he completed at Boston University Hospital, and thought that wasn't enough. So you decided to do a fellowship after that at Baylor College of Medicine. And boy, that's around the country. You've been around the U.S. and back with that training stint.
I have. I've circumvented the United States.
Very good. And now he's in private practice at one of the Southeast's leading infertility groups, Reproductive Biology Associates in Atlanta, Georgia. He's very well known in town. He's been featured on CNN, on the Learning Channel, and has been named one of Atlanta's top doctors. So we're thrilled to have you today.
Thank you.
Well, let's start out. I would be interested in hearing a little bit about your course around the world and how you got interested in this specialty.
Well, I was first introduced to this in the second year of my urology residency when my chief resident expressed an interest to do a male infertility fellowship in Baylor. And it was an area that was just developing. And then when he returned, I was still in my final year of my urology residency and had a chance to spend time with him and enjoyed immensely what he was doing, and then really enjoyed the outcomes of what he was doing, mm-hmm. which was to help men at that time father mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. And compared to a lot of the other options I had, that seemed to have a real appeal in terms of contributing significantly to the quality of people's lives. Mm-hmm. And then I had a chairman who, Bob Crane, who was very instrumental in encouraging pretty much all of his residents to go into a fellowship, even though we were all chomping at the bit to go into private practice.
Get the slave labor over with.
And so those two things sort of combined with then getting the honor of being accepted into the fellowship at the Baylor College of Medicine, and Dr. Lipschultz was gracious to accept me there, and he was one that ran the program, and so I was there for a year, again, thinking I would just finish that year of training and then go into private practice, and I'd always wanted to go back to my home state of Oregon. But when I finished, there was just a huge academic demand to do male infertility with a real emphasis on male sexual health. And that was before the whole male sexual health mm-hmm. industry had sort of sprouted up. Mm-hmm. And the offers were just too good to refuse. And so it was very attractive to limit my practice to that area of medicine and provide that kind of service to couples who were sorely in need of it at that point in time.
Right. So I want to congratulate you and your group. I know that you recently had a big celebration for your 30,000 babies in 30 years that I think was just about a month or so ago.
It was. Yeah, we celebrated that at the Atlanta Zoo. Mm-hmm. And we've tracked sort of the number of pregnancies that have been ongoing. I can remember when I joined the practice shortly after that, it was at the 5,000 level, and now it's at the 30,000 level.
Probably hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. You don't stop often and take measure of really what you've done. So it was a great time for us to look back and then to enjoy that with as many of the couples and their kids that showed up at the party.
I heard quite a few came from quite a distance, so I know they're grateful for their families. And let's talk about how you do that in your specialty. So let's just start out talking about male infertility, if you could tell us a little bit about how you define that and kind of what are the parameters in terms of when they start seeing a physician versus stopping on their own?
Yeah, it's a lot broader of an issue than you would think because issues can range anywhere from erectile dysfunction mm-hmm. that can contribute to infertility all the way up to specific issues with the sperm. And it's classically defined as sort of any issue on the male side that is making it more difficult for that couple to establish a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. We typically will tell couples that they need to try probably at least 9 months on their own. If there's no other extenuating circumstances that would cause them to suspect there's a problem, obviously if that's the case, then they want to seek care as soon as they feel there's a need to. So, but typically if a couple's been trying for 9 months, then that's usually when they want to seek care. Mm-hmm. And the critical thing is for both partners to be evaluated.
Mm-hmm. So, I know typically when you think infertility, I think people's thoughts first go to the woman, but we're actually finding that it's just as much the guys too. So that's why it's important to have both together.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, society and even science for a long period of time used to put most of the burden on the mm-hmm. woman. But now we know, just as we've studied the area, that probably about 50% of the time there's a male factor that's contributing to the problem, which, if not identified, can make it difficult even with really state-of-the-art technology mm-hmm. if it's only focused on the wife.
Mm-hmm. And if it's about, we're looking at just general couples, like say in the U.S., not worldwide, but just here in our backyard, about what percent of the population would be having fertility problems?
The last time they looked at that, it was about 12 to 15%.
Okay.
But as the population is aging and as there is a greater trend for couples to postpone
right.
establishing a pregnancy due to educational goals or vocational goals, that number is probably increasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking offline about how I used to work in the OB side of things. After you guys would get them pregnant, they'd come over to our side to be cared for and delivered. And I think our average age for a primip was somewhere in the 30s.
Correct.
So I don't know what you see on your side, but we saw certainly people were delaying. And Dorothy was here talking about the anti-Mullerian hormone. So know where you stand and get help. So I think you're thinking, don't wait too long.
That's right.
And bring both partners in to get evaluated is a great place to start. So let's start with basic. What are some of the male factor conditions that we need for successful conception? Let's just start there. We talked about this whole broad range of.
Right. I mean, if you boil it down to its basics, essentially you need a large number of sperm. And of course, this is in a natural context.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to be able to deliver those sperm, which typically is done in the context of intercourse. And then there has to be good quality sperm.
Mm-hmm. So what's a large number?
Well, in my business, and now with some of the new standards that have come out to guide people in terms of the likelihood of a pregnancy, usually the more the better. Okay. On average, you like to see about 200 million sperm in the specimen.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can see pregnancies in much lower numbers, and you can see couples have difficulties with much higher numbers, but that's about the average. The problem with the semen analysis, which is where you actually determine, you know, the number of sperm that's in the specimen that the husband has to work with, is that it really doesn't determine fertility. It really will tell you something about probability, but not fertility.
So it tells you a piece of the pie.
Exactly.
Not all of the pie. We're going to talk a little bit about how you test and do that in a little bit. So we know we have to have healthy sperm. We know we have to have a way to deliver it. In terms, they have to be motile, so we have motion, and make sure that we get in there. So let's talk a little bit about what you're looking for. A patient comes in. They're coming in as a couple. You're going to evaluate the male side of the equation. What happens to them when they come?
Well, the approach to the male is the same with that you would approach any sort of potential medical problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd go through just a standard history, and then with some specific focus on those parts of the history that are germane to their reproduction. So you would look at their past surgical history, particularly if there's been any childhood surgeries performed. You would look at their pubertal development. You'd be sure that you take sort of a long history of any medications that they're on, any other operations that they've had. And then you would do a pretty thorough physical examination, again with that same kind of focus. You're looking for any evidence of hormonal issues, any evidence of sort of congenital abnormalities, developmental abnormalities. And then you have a real specific focus on the genitalia, looking primarily for normal development, normal structures, normal anatomy. And with the history and the physical, typically you, about 70% of the time you can start to get a sense of what's happening. But then the cornerstone for the laboratory testing, which usually takes place in all men, is you'll get two semen analyses. And then sometimes based on the history and what that semen analysis shows or what those two semen analyses shows, then you might do some further diagnostic testing.
Do you do them apart so you can compare?
You do. I mean, you want to have at least two semen analyses. Sometimes you need a third. Mm-hmm. The problem with the semen analysis is that it's not a real standardized test like a lot of tests that people get. So it's not like a cholesterol study or, let's say, an electrolyte study, which have some pretty tight regulations, and you can control the specimens that you obtain. So there's the potential for a lot of artifact, and then there's a lot of subjectivity as well based on where the test is done, because different laboratories perform them differently. Not everybody does it the same. They don't always have the same facility with using those specimens. So you want to be sure you do that testing in a lab that does a lot.
Do you guys have your own lab?
We do.
So you're able to control it here
exactly.
In your situation.
And most reproductive centers have their mm-hmm. own lab, and most of those labs are pretty reliable. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people can do semen analyses, whether it's in a doctor's office or whether it's in a hospital laboratory, mm-hmm. and you can see a lot of discrepant findings there. So typically you like to get two, mm-hmm. and then that'll give you sort of a sense, mm-hmm. you know, of what their reproductive potential is.
Mm-hmm. And then they have labs on that visit?
They might.
Okay.
If there is indication for looking at hormonal levels, mm-hmm. Because hormone levels can tell you in the husband if there's an underlying production issue or mm-hmm. imbalance that might be causing problems, either with sperm production or transport, blood work might be done. And then based on the history and the physical and the semen analysis, you might do some imaging studies. That usually is ultrasound imaging, you know, looking mm-hmm. at the testicle, looking mm-hmm. at the prostate, mm-hmm. Looking at the vas deferens that goes from the testicle to the prostate. And then you might do additional testing. Sometimes genetic testing is indicated. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes more sophisticated sperm function testing mm-hmm. is indicated as well.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything special that the patients need to do to prepare before they come to see you? Like, would they stop medications if they have to give a sample, or would they abstain from sex for a certain amount of time? Or
at the first visit, usually not.
Okay.
Now, sometimes if the patient's
sometimes if the
patient's traveling out of town, we might tell them that if you want to do your first semen analysis here, you know, have at least 3 days of abstinence when you come in, and be sure you feel comfortable collecting that specimen in the office. It's not uncommon most men have had a semen analysis done mm-hmm. By their wife's OBGYN, and it's turned up being less than optimal, so
they're being referred
to that. So mm-hmm. I do tell them, if you have any past testing, if you have any past medical records, mm-hmm. definitely bring those in with you.
Okay, good advice. All right, so we get you your detective hat on. You look at everything. You do the evaluation, the exam. You start to get things back. Let's kind of go through what are the potential causes, and let's start with variceal, and then go through some of the obstruction hormones and some of the different things that may be causes.
Yeah, a varicocele is just like a varicose vein that you can get in your leg, but in this case it develops around the testicle. Mm-hmm. It'll occur in about 12 to 15% of men, and then in about 60% of those men it can cause problems either with sperm production or with testosterone production. If it's present and it's causing a problem, typically it's going to be visible or palpable mm-hmm. on exam. Some people would recommend doing imaging. But if it's present and you can implicate it as being the problem, because it doesn't always cause a problem, then you can sometimes make an argument for correcting that.
Would this be like the number one cause of male infertility, varicocele?
It occurs, I would say about 40% of the time.
High. Yeah. That's pretty high. Okay, and what would be some other things that you would see? Let's go to hormones. So what might be off? What are you looking for?
Yeah, hormones are critical for the development of sperm mm-hmm. and to some degree for the transport of sperm. Mm-hmm. The one that I'll most commonly see is if there's either a depression of testosterone production, mm-hmm. And that usually indicates there's something going on in the mm-hmm. testicle that's abnormal, so that it's not only diminished in terms of its ability to make sperm, but also its ability to make testosterone. And then sometimes there can be hormonal imbalances at the level of the pituitary mm-hmm. that's not making the gonadotropins, which the brain makes to tell the testicle to make either sperm mm-hmm. or testosterone. A common one I'm starting to see now more and more is men come in on testosterone. So their own testosterone suppressed, and their gonadotropins are essentially non-existent. And sometimes they've been told this will help you be more fertile, which is a misnomer. Or sometimes they've just been put on it for social reasons. That, you know, they feel tired, or they're just not as energetic as they used to be. And it, you know, it's widely advertised now. The problem is men that come in on it come in because they have no sperm. And so that's a very common diagnosis now in my practice.
Well, so that's a shift in your practice, things you're seeing.
It is.
I know in the research, too, one of the things I was kind of surprised to see, just because I think more of obstruction than other problems, would be anti-sperm antibodies.
Yeah, those can develop in men that have had some kind of injury, infection, surgery to the testicle. The sperm forms in men after puberty, which is well after the man's immune system develops. And so the body sort of hides the sperm from the immune system. And if there's any breaches in that sequestration mechanism, then the body can develop antibodies to it. The antibodies may or may not be a problem. Sometimes they're there and they don't cause any problem. Sometimes they're there and they do. So it's a little dicey to figure out when it is and when it isn't a problem necessarily.
Just one potential.
Right.
Another one, let's talk a little bit about chromosome abnormality. So I'm wondering, with adoption and infertility and sperm donors in these days and times, do people have a pretty good handle on their history when they come to see you? To know what I mean, obviously if they have a genetic defect that they're living with, that's going to be one thing. But if there's something that is a marker that doesn't show up.
Right. Yeah, the men that I see that would, well, first of all, obviously one of the areas we are, you know, seeing greater and greater awareness of and is becoming sort of a bigger part of causes for male infertility are underlying chromosomal abnormalities. The most common one that we see is Y chromosome problems. There'll be parts of the Y chromosome that are missing. Now, physiologically and phenotypically, or at least from an appearance standpoint, that type of deficit doesn't really have any major impact. So these guys are completely healthy as far as they can tell. And they'll have usually sperm numbers that are non-existent or extremely low. And that's usually the first indicator that that might be there.
There's something underlying.
But we really didn't even know that that was really the cause for the low numbers in those guys until about, I would say, 8 or 10 years ago. Now that we know if that's the case and it's there, the good news is you can make a diagnosis very quickly. And you can then start to counsel them about what's their risk of transmitting this and then what kind of treatments to use, because at this point we don't have any way to go in and correct those kind of deficiencies. So it really streamlines the process, gives them some real definitive information, and we're getting a greater and greater awareness of that
genetics, at more levels. You can find markers and many more markers than we have even the year before.
Exactly.
So that's helping you a lot. Let's talk a little bit about environmental and lifestyle causes of male infertility. Things from weight, smoking, caffeine, all those things we hear. Too much hot tubbing, too much fun, all those things.
Well, there's a lot of things that get a lot of press that don't really cause a problem.
So let's educate people on those. Those are easy.
So the things I can tell people, or at least they don't, I can tell men they don't need to get too concerned about and change their lifestyles radically about is first their underwear. So it really doesn't make a difference. Bicycle seats. That usually doesn't make a big difference. Mountain Dew.
Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
Hot tubs, hot showers. Even caffeine is really not a problem. So a lot of those things, people extrapolate anecdotal data on how temperature can have an adverse effect on sperm and then tend to take that into these lifestyle recommendations, which haven't been shown to really have any major impact. Recent electronic ones that have sort of hit the ground have been like cell phones and laptops. And so a lot of times I can tell people you don't need to get too obsessive about that if you don't want to. But some of the common offenders that I do see is marijuana use. It tends to be more common than you would think. Tobacco use. That obviously should be curtailed as much as possible.
Is that relating to low sperm production, or what is the effect?
The effect of the tobacco typically is the byproducts of sort of the burned tobacco that tends to affect more activity and quality.
Okay.
Alcohol consumption if it's in really high levels, mm-hmm. can be a problem. Mm-hmm. But typically, if alcohol is going to be causing a problem, you're going to see it affect other organ systems as well. So just a couple glasses a day are probably not a big deal. And you can probably consume anywhere from 10 to 12 drinks a week and really not mm-hmm. be worse for the wear in terms of your fertility. Mm-hmm. And then you pretty much want to be sure that couples, at least in the context of timing intercourse, you know, are mm-hmm. pretty aware of how to do that, because mm-hmm. some couples really aren't. And then if you have two working couples, sometimes it's really difficult just to coordinate mm-hmm. schedules, you know, mm-hmm. so that's sometimes going to be an issue as well.
Mm-hmm. So you have a little window. You're going to have to pay attention there. Let's talk about environmental. Is there anything you're seeing as far as environmental or exposure or anything on that side that would be something to pay attention to in terms of male infertility?
Yeah, not in general. Okay. I mean, there are specific niches. Mm-hmm. Pesticide handlers tend to be mm-hmm. one that...
It's occupational, maybe.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can see people exposed to sort of aniline dyes and things of that mm-hmm. nature. But just in general, that's probably not the case.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we've talked about some of the causes. We've talked about the workup. Let's talk about what we can do then. So once you find out what you think the main problem is, what are some options and treatments that you can offer patients?
Yeah, the treatment options will usually break down into two general categories. You'll either try to correct the problem mm-hmm. in hopes of getting the sperm numbers and or quality better so that they'll have a better chance of getting pregnant, hopefully on their own, or with even the more advanced techniques if you need to. Or the other alternative is to compensate for the problem. Mm-hmm. Really not try to correct it, mm-hmm. but either try to temporarily fix it or try to use what they have, mm-hmm. you know, in combination mm-hmm. with assisted techniques.
Mm-hmm. So surgery, let's talk about what you can do. Like, so for like varicocele, what would you do?
Yeah, if there's a varicocele that's implicated and if they want to correct that problem, either to prevent further deterioration mm-hmm. or to optimize, mm-hmm. then with a pretty, you know, small outpatient procedure, you can mm-hmm. go in and seal off that vein mm-hmm. so that it stops damaging the testicle. Mm-hmm. And then in about 80% of cases, they'll get recovery. And then you can see pregnancy rates, you know, as high as 60% just with intercourse after that.
So how long would the effect take? If they had the surgery, then would they cycle it like within a couple of months?
You can start to see sperm parameters improve in about 3 months.
Okay.
You know, the life cycle for a sperm to be formed is about 60 days, mm-hmm. and then it's another probably 2 weeks before that sperm actually shows up in the ejaculate. So there's a lag time, mm-hmm. and then there is sort of a cumulative effect over time. So mm-hmm. you can see numbers keep climbing up to 9 months after that kind of procedure.
Okay, so surgery might be one option that you would use. As far as medication, if it's something like a hormone imbalance or some other adjustment that needs made on the production side, you would be able to help compensate through medication.
That's right. There are medications that if, let's say, there's not enough hormone being produced to stimulate sperm production, you can start them on. Usually it'll be, in some respects, the same medications you might put a woman on mm-hmm. to improve ovulation
right.
because the physiology is the same. Mm-hmm. It's just the end product is different. So there's medications like that you can put them on. There's a whole subset of men that we don't have any workable diagnosis for other than they're just unknown. And sometimes those men you can treat, you know, mm-hmm. with medication.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about assisted reproductive technologies. I know that's what you guys are famous for, helping
that's
out
right.
and having all the special tricks of the trade there. So things such as sperm retrieval and sperm donor use and things like that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, one of the great things about RBA, and one of the reasons I initially started collaborating with them when I began working at Emory, was because they had really an excellent laboratory that was being pretty innovative in terms of assisted reproductive techniques, primarily revolving around the manipulation of sperm into the egg. Mm-hmm. Now that's commonly known as in vitro fertilization mm-hmm. and intracytoplasmic sperm injection. But what that did, at least for my field, is it really lowered the sperm requirements, mm-hmm. you know, to enable couples to establish a mm-hmm. pregnancy. So men who previously would have been terminally sterile, mm-hmm. even if they had sort of micro quantities of sperm, now had the potential to establish a pregnancy because of these techniques. So we've seen men, either because of unreconstructable obstructive processes, and you can see that in some cases, or in men who have really low levels of production, whether that's genetic or hormonal, there's the capacity now to go in and actually retrieve sperm, you know, from the testicle, or sometimes the structures around the testicle, and then use those sperm, which typically would yield no pregnancy, just in the context of normal intercourse or even insemination, and use in vitro fertilization, you know, to get the sperm where it needs to go, enable fertilization to occur, and then generate embryos that can help that couple establish a pregnancy.
So women's egg cycles are cyclical, but for sperm production, you're always producing something. So is that something that it doesn't really matter, the timing for sperm retrieval? Or do you do something to kind of boost them before you do a procedure?
You can. There are situations where you can try to recover sperm production so that you can go in and retrieve sperm. But most retrievals occur on the day of the wife's ovulation, which is the day of her egg retrieval. And the reason you're doing that is because even though you can freeze sperm and thaw sperm and get usable sperm after that, it's usually optimal in those situations where you have really low yields of sperm to use fresh sperm. And that gives the couple the best possible outcome. That's important because IVF, even in perfect conditions, only has, I would say, about a 60% success rate, and then it goes down from there. So you hate to handicap them any further, you know, by not using fresh sperm if you can.
But you brought up a good topic. I'm thinking of, like, Lance Armstrong in the news, testicular cancer, sperm preservation. And so can you talk a little bit about how that works? What are some parameters? What are some markers where it makes sense for guys to really start looking younger? I know cancer certainly is that the most primary diagnosis?
It is. I mean, anytime there's going to be some kind of toxic insult to the testicle, and at least in the medical field with men, that typically is receiving chemotherapy, and that can be, usually you see that with leukemias, lymphomas, testicular cancers, sometimes some more unusual muscle-type cancers. It's important that those men, and it's not uncommon for them to be adolescent and single, so they're not really contemplating reproduction at that point. They're just trying to get cured and extend their life. But it's important for the care providers to say, you know, we need to talk about getting some of your sperm and preserving that, because we have the ability to do that, and there's no guarantees on the backside of this that you're going to have sperm to show for it, even though most likely you're going to survive, you know, well into your reproductive years.
So do you think that the oncology community is tuned into that as an option with their adolescent?
They're getting better. They're getting better at doing it. And in Atlanta, actually, they are pretty good, because there's a local sperm bank here called Zytec, which they have pretty immediate access to. The challenge is, most of these patients, along with their oncologists, are on a pretty tight time schedule, so you got to be able to get them in pretty soon, get it frozen, so they can then start their chemotherapy.
Okay, very good. And how long does sperm freeze? How long, indefinitely, or what are the tests?
Once it's frozen, it's good indefinitely.
And then when you thaw it out, it's exactly the same?
Not necessarily.
You have to.
There's always a subset of that sperm population that's going to be damaged.
Okay.
And so you don't end up with the same numbers you began with. So you want to be sure you have a critical number you can freeze. But if that's all you have, then that's what you want to freeze.
And then is there a technology way to kind of separate the good from the bad?
A little bit. You tend to use sort of observational indicators like activity and shape. But you can't really press too hard, because then you'll start to
damage
the sperm that you want to use.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, you tend to use some crude measures for that.
Okay, very good. Now, I know this whole process for the couple and the men and the women is very stressful. So what do you guys do over at RBA as far as psychosocial support for couples and men going through this up and down to trying to achieve a pregnancy route?
Yes, RBA has a lot of things that they try to do to make it less stressful, you know, for the couples going through. So we provide acupuncture services, yoga services, counseling services that they have access to, and then give them at least names of local support groups, you know, like Resolve, that they can begin to connect with other people who are going through the same thing and help them along their journey. so that they get a sense of where they're at, where they're going, and then realize they're not alone in the process.
Okay, very good. I know that's an important component of it, too. Let's talk a little bit about costs of the treatment. I know we were talking off air about me being an infertility patient. Back in those days, there was zero insurance help. So everything was really out of pocket for these very new technologies. It's expensive. But I think some insurances are actually covering it these days. So it's probably a mixed bag, I'm guessing. But can you give us some idea of how much some of these procedures cost or financial options that you offer for the patients?
Right. The good news for the husband is that most of the testing and evaluation, and I would say 80% of the treatments for men, are typically covered by insurance because there are other medical issues involved that require, you know, them to get treatment that will then enable their, you know, insurance provider to provide some degree of subsidization. Where you tend to see insurance companies start to pull back coverage is if you have to get into the assisted techniques like insemination or in vitro fertilization. And then that's where the out-of-pocket expenses can start to really go up for couples. But there are great ways of financing that. And there are financing plans that RBA has that couples can use if they qualify for. They can help them sort of finance that over a certain period of time. And then you can engage in sometimes some shared risk programs that will enable you to, for a little bit more money up front, at least have a guaranteed outcome. So you're not going to walk away with nothing to show for your investment.
Very good. Well, that's always helpful, I know, as people are trying to figure out what they're going to do. I want to talk a little bit about in that 9-month period that they're on their own kind of trying before they get there. You mentioned earlier that a lot of patients really don't know some basics about how to get pregnant, like the timing, 3 days around ovulation or whatever. Any guidelines that you have for the listeners out there that they're on the cusp of getting ready to come, but they're not quite there?
The general rule would be sure that the wife knows when she's if she's ovulating and when she's ovulating. There's a lot of ways to detect that, whether it's by just dates or physical signs or even these over-the-counter ovulation
I've seen them,
kits.
Even at the grocery store, right?
And those are starting to get more and more sophisticated.
Are they accurate?
They are. I mean, if they are, if they demonstrate, you know, the appropriate hormonal surge, then they are. They tend to be pretty accurate and pretty predictable. And then for the husband, and obviously along with the wife, then you want to begin intercourse about 2 days before you think that's going to happen and have intercourse every other day until 2 days after. Now, sometimes those recommendations get changed based on what's really going on with the couple after they come in for evaluation.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. Now, I know things we were talking about, things change all the time in your field, trying to keep up with these new technologies and what's kind of happening. Is there anything on the forefront that you're looking at, like we talked briefly alluding to sperm maturation techniques that are being investigated or anything that's exciting that you're looking toward?
Yeah, the at least on the male side, the two things that we're seeing is a better understanding of how the structures outside the genetic material in the sperm works. And so having a better understanding of how to identify sperm that are going to be more effective than sperm that are not. And then just in the context of being able to make sperm, there is some pretty exciting work being done to take men who aren't making sperm and potentially enable them with either stem cell or other sort of out-of-the-body maturational type processes to help them make sperm out of their own cells.
Very good. I appreciate that. Now, we're almost to the end, believe it or not. We've been here for a while, but I want to end with two things. One is we have listeners listen. They take a lot of notes, and they're learning a lot of stuff, but they're going to actually remember the stories, the patient's stories, the hope that they have. Can you think of any stories you could share, not names, but just patients that you started with one, boy, you didn't have much hope, and here was a good positive outcome? I know you have 30,000 of them to your credit, but maybe there's a couple that you remember quite well.
Yeah, in regards to the ones that I've seen, and there's obviously numerous stories that my partners could tell as well, the one that really comes to mind was a couple that had been told, due to the fact that the husband didn't have any sperm in the ejaculate, that there really wasn't anything they could do. And then sort of as a last-ditch effort, they came to one of our patient seminars, and they were looking at potentially moving ahead, you know, not using the husband's sperm, but had a chance to talk with me, and they were very, I would say, enthusiastic and very open to anything we could do. And as a result, they decided to take another look at him. And so we discovered it was a production problem. It was a pretty severe production problem. And I didn't really have high hopes for them. But they were willing to invest the time. They didn't feel they had to move within the next 2 to 3 months to some other alternative. So we began some treatment on him. And then with some biopsies that occurred over the next 6 to 12 months, we were able to document that he did have sort of micro quantities of sperm that started to show up. So we then had them decide to move into an IVF cycle with a sperm retrieval. And again, went into that process really with my fingers crossed, because I didn't know if we'd be able to even find sperm if they were there, because they were so few in number. But we did, and it was probably about 10 to 12 sperm that we were able to find. The wife didn't have a great stimulation. I think she had maybe 5 eggs, and out of those, 3 fertilized, and then they ended up having 2 that they put back, but that was it. And morphologically, they didn't look great at all. So we really gave them kind of really poor outcomes and poor prognosis based on what was happening. But then she ended up getting pregnant, and they were one of the most rewarding couples that I've treated, just because of the time that they were willing to put in, the faith they had in us, and then the technology we were able to bring to bear on their condition, and then the outcome, which at least tells me that we really don't know exactly how this works. And so I tell most couples, not that exact story every time, but I just tell them, you know, don't give up hope. In spite of how high the obstacles are, you really don't have to give up hope unless we really think there's nothing we can do.
So that's a great story.
That's a great story.
That's a great story. You just never know. But certainly intervention, when you get to the point that you're not getting results sooner than later,
will
be helpful there. Well, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with us today. And we've learned a lot. And boy, you guys have to keep up, and things change all the time. But 30,000 kids in Atlanta and surrounding areas in 30 years is quite an accomplishment. So that's got to feel great.
It does feel very good.
Very good. Congratulations. And I want to give all the listeners out there a chance to find you and learn a little bit about RBA a little bit more. So why don't you tell us kind of how you're organized, where you are, what services you have there, and then we'll end that with the phone numbers and the website.
Yeah, we are, our main office is next to Northside Hospital. It's at 1100 Johnson Ferry Road, and at that site, essentially, we can provide, you know, comprehensive care, you know, for both the male and the female, and that can range anywhere from real simple manipulations all the way up to real advanced stuff, and they can just call the office or email us online, and then we sort of get back in touch with you and schedule an appointment and have you come in. We also have satellite offices, and sometimes that can make it a little more accessible for couples. We have one in Marietta, there's one in Lawrenceville, there's one in Forsyth, and one in Cumming. And so we are reproductive endocrinologists, staff those satellites, and they're available there to see patients a little more locally, and that enables couples to do a lot of the groundwork and not have to travel so far.
Very good. So your website is?
Let's see if I can get this correctly. It's RBA-online.
And the office phone number?
Is 404-257-1900.
Very good. Thank you so much. Well, we appreciate you coming, and we'll look forward to coming you back and having another topic and more success stories in the future. Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
All your listeners, please check healthgate.com for some savings offers for you, and take a look at what the sponsor has for you there. Appreciate it. Have a good afternoon, and tune in next time.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.